Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How realistic are the promises of the Green Revolution? A growing number of cheerleaders for the movement talk not only about its benefits for slowing climate change and cleaning the air, but its potential for stimulating or even rescuing our faltering economy. But while he's all for changing consumption practices and reducing greenhouse gas generation, my guest today believes some of the assumptions about the financial benefits of clean technologies may be too optimistic, at least in the forms they are being proposed right now. Matthew E. Kahn is professor of economics at the University of California at Los Angeles and author of the book Green Cities, Urban Growth, and the Environment. His article for the May-June issue of Foreign Policy magazine is called Think Again, the Green Economy. Matt, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thank you.
Your first assertion is that going green will not end the recession, in part because it wasn't our old dirty ways that caused it. Can you talk about that?
So when I talk to people, Los Angeles has experienced some falling home prices and job destruction. And so in California, with an enormous budget deficit right now, it isn't the decline of manufacturing. What's going on in California is this this recession is taking place as home prices fall and a lack of confidence among consumers. President Obama may succeed in parts of his stimulus package to reverse that, but I don't think it's the old economy that has dragged us down into this recession.
How much of green technology development is economically, at least, a zero-sum game?
So what's going on in California? Los Angeles looks to Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley was a great success in Northern California of helping to bring about the computer revolution and Google and all these great companies we now take for granted. There's the hope in Los Angeles now, and I presume in other Texas cities as well, that there's going to be job growth opportunities from the new green economy. The open question is how many jobs this could be.
And I guess what happens is that as certain jobs and industries are created and enhanced, other ones will naturally have to fall away.
So you're right that something that nerd economists are discussing is the in-capitalism of job creation and job destruction. So if President Obama successfully passes this Waxman bill, and it's such that there's now a price on releasing carbon and greenhouse gas emissions, this will create incentives for green tech companies to grow, but energy-intensive companies, whether they're cement or heavy manufacturing, will suffer in the U.S. As their price of inputs goes up and their profits will fall. So you're right that there's simultaneously going to be job creation and job destruction.
What sort of government incentives do you think are appropriate to encourage the green economy?
What 99% of economists would vote in favor of is putting a price on greenhouse gas emissions. And I know we're not allowed to use the word tax, but economists are big fans of incentives. And so with the challenge of global warming and climate change, if we could put a credible price on releasing carbon through a cap and trade system, that to economists, this would be sufficient for triggering the great American capitalism to focus on greening our economy on a number of dimensions.
So if not cap and trade, we actually tax carbon specifically, or we find a way to calculate the actual cost of the products that we're consuming.
Yes. And so you're right that there's a number of people deeply interested in these ecological footprints of so if you drink a cup of coffee at Dunkin' Donuts or Starbucks, they have to pay the workers to make that cup of coffee, and they have to pay for the real estate to sell you the cup of coffee. But there's some environmental impacts which they are not taking into account. And environmental economists would say it's very important for these capitalist firms to face the full cost of their decisions, whether it's buying a Hummer or producing coal-fired power. And if these companies faced these incentives to not pollute, they would quickly become very green.
Are there useful formulas in existence right now, Matt, for making a determination about how big the carbon footprint is on a cup of coffee or a newspaper or anything else that we might buy?
It's really tricky, and it's going to raise a host of issues similar to the accounting industry. So if I asked you how profitable is Google, they would call in their favorite accounting firm to do an evaluation of their books. And we know that there's a whole host of issues with accounting. I predict something similar is going to happen in a new field of environmental accounting. So if I asked you, is Starbucks a green company? How would you even begin to answer that? One might ask, well, do they get their beans locally? Or do they have to ship them thousands of miles? Do they pay their workers a sustainable wage? So how do we know a green, sustainable company when we see one? I think that's going to raise a series of philosophical issues.
Yeah. What do you think are the most important components? There are only so many figures that we can work with on any particular product. What are the most important things to consider? Is it, in fact, the miles that something travels and the energy that we use to specifically produce that product? How far back in the chain do we need to go?
Chris, that's a great question. And to make fun of myself, that was actually a critique of my Green Cities book, that people said to me, Matt, you didn't name names. You didn't rank Austin relative to Houston relative to Boston of who's the greenest. And my wimp-out answer was, I didn't want to tell people what characteristics of cities, whether it's climate, air pollution, carbon dioxide, to prioritize. Different people might have different priorities. But if our prime environmental priority is fighting climate change, then it should be all about the carbon emissions. But if we care about public health, then air quality and water quality matter. So to some degree, I can't answer your question unless you tell me your priorities over these different environmental characteristics.
So I guess it's something that as a society, we're going to have to sit down and give serious thought to.
Yes, and as a diverse society, we're not going to agree. So a simple example, if Houston has worse smog than L.A., but has higher, but L.A. has higher greenhouse gas emissions, which is the greener city? It comes down to, do you weight smog versus greenhouse gas emissions as your priority?
Why is the government's track record for spotting the right new technologies to pursue and encourage so poor?
That is the million-dollar question. So economists jump up and down and say that government has a terrible record for picking winners. People point to Japan with its MITI and say the Japanese government has subsidized through its industrial policy industries. But when economists took a look back, economists were surprised to find that Japan's MITI has not been good at picking winners and fostering the next Google or the next Prius. Economists would say that we need to experiment. Let 1,000 little companies compete, and the next Dell or the next Starbucks will emerge through competition, not through government picking winners. The challenge with picking winners is, does the government have a fair competition, or does it award it through some nepotistic way to some son-in-law versus an open competition to see who's the Kobe Bryant and the king of the lot?
Are there good ways for the government to encourage that private entrepreneurial experimentation, or will the market cope with this itself?
You keep asking good questions. To an economist, this incentive on carbon would be the start. There's many terrific engineers in Texas. It would interest me if I sat down with them, how many of them are focusing their entrepreneurial effort on green products versus if we had a cap and trade on carbon, how many would take a second look at inventing solar panels or more fuel efficient vehicles? What's going on in Los Angeles is a private-public partnership that the city is trying to build a green tech corridor to encourage private firms to show up, sort of a field of dreams effect of creating an ecosystem to attract capitalist firms and then for these firms to feed off each other and learn from each other.
So something that we've talked a lot about in Texas is this idea that we were going to push for alternative technologies, and Boone Pickens had a whole plan, and then
yes,
the price of oil dropped, and now he's sort of holding off on that. How great a factor are oil prices in the speed with which any of these new technologies ultimately come to market?
Crucial. Tom Friedman, the New York Times columnist, wrote a fascinating editorial exactly on that point. He said that the reason that Western Europe is so green is that they've been able to commit to these high gas prices. So they basically have high gas taxes so that even if market fundamentals say that oil prices should be low, there's a high tax to keep gas prices at $4 or $5 a gallon. The commitment effect of that is that green entrepreneurs like T. Boone Pickens, not because they're an Al Gore do-gooder, but just out of, in a world where gas is $5 a gallon, Dick Cheney would consider building a Prius and buying a Prius. And so it's this commitment. You need government to step in and send a credible commitment to businessmen and businesswomen that if you go green, you won't regret this decision. And you're more likely to regret it if you expect that gas prices can fall back down to a dollar a gallon in the future.
On the other hand, you know, we are so often encouraged to look at Europe for examples of successful green economies, but you see the lessons from there as far more complicated than that. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. So it is true that Europe deserves some success. People point to Denmark with its wind turbines, but what gets lost is the denominator. In Europe, other nations like Spain have tried a variety of programs that haven't worked, and yet we sort of fixate on the winners. And so, again, economists would say that government subsidies often are not cost-effective, and an optimist would fixate on the good data points of things that have gone right, but that Europe has had many failures. And to make an even tougher point, it's sometimes the case with green policy that this is sort of a politically correct cover for industrial subsidies to favored industries. And so that's something that worries hard-headed economists.
So what can we take from those failures, given that the price of oil is, in fact, far higher in Europe, including in Spain, where things haven't taken off the way they were expected to?
What Europe has going for it is its compact cities. And so with these high gas prices of people living in these high buildings, so they're not living the American dream of sprawled, low-density housing revolving around the car, they've reconfigured their society in compact, dense cities. And so as crime has fallen in the U.S., we're a diverse society. There's always going to be people who want to live in the suburbs and drive to work. But the commitment to these high energy prices in Europe has created these compact cities, which offer a number of environmental benefits.
You've written, as we discussed, a lot about green cities in the past. Would you give us a good working definition of what that is?
My favorite, and this comes back to this priorities, what has gone right in a city like San Francisco is this beautiful geography so that it's a temperate city, but also this clean air and this commitment to open space and in terms of greenhouse gas emissions of a relatively small footprint. So a very livable city on a day-to-day basis in terms of quality of life, but also a city that's a good global citizen. And so I try to make these two things of local quality of life and global being a good citizen. So unfortunately, a city like Houston gets a bad rap on both of those. I have been down to Houston, had a very nice time there, but many Americans point to Houston and say this city's carbon footprint is too big. And so some would say that that's not a green city for those who care about carbon dioxide criteria.
How often is being green really a factor, at least in this country, as much of fortunate geography as anything else?
So a city like Pittsburgh used to be, there can be reversal of fortune. A city like Pittsburgh used to be a nasty brown city because of steel creating tons of air and water pollution, major ambient particulate issues. But the silver lining of the decline of the Rust Belt has been that many of these cities have now rediscovered themselves. Providence, Rhode Island, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, have reinvented themselves as green cities. And so we can see reversals depending on which industries are the golden goose of the local economy and whether the citizens support a green agenda. So, for example, the mayor of San Francisco is trying to get rid of plastic in his city in garbage recycling and wants to run for governor on that platform.
Matthew Econ is my guest. He's professor of economics at UCLA, and he's written a piece for the current Foreign Policy magazine called Think Again, the Green Economy. You're welcome to join our conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is UCLA Professor of Economics Matthew E. Kahn. He's got a book out called Green Cities, Urban Growth and the Environment. He's also published an article in the May-June issue of Foreign Policy magazine called Think Again, the Green Economy. If you would like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Matt, you mentioned San Francisco, and I think lots of people love it, but, you know, what is a middle-class salary in Dallas, Texas doesn't go very far there. Are we at risk of creating green cities that price most normal people out of living there?
You're on to something. There is a literature that I think everyone is aware of, but that universities professors have only figured out recently, that cities like Portland and San Francisco, do they zone themselves into being nice? An unintended consequence of zoning restrictions to allow for open space is this makes it hard to build new housing, and that makes it less affordable. And so there's an interesting question of whether the middle class gets squeezed out of these cities, either intentionally or unintentionally, as a byproduct of zoning, of smart growth zoning. And so I think that's a very real concern.
If it is happening, are there ways to mitigate that?
In my own work, it partially depends on where people work. So if everyone works downtown, then locations near downtown are going to get very valuable. But something that's gone on in the United States is employment sprawl. So Google's headquarters is far from downtown San Francisco. In a world where employment is located at multiple parts of a city, it may be possible to have multiple compact regions and avoid some of these issues. But you're right that Portland, San Francisco, Boston, these liberal cities with high quality of life, this in part has driven up home prices due to direct effects, but also just zoning and housing regulations have also gentrified these cities.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is Matthew E. Kahn. Let's go to Flower Mound and speak with Shirley. Hi, Shirley.
Hi there. I'm going to change the topic. I want to talk about recycling here in Texas. I lived in Germany for 5 years in the 90s, and they are very fully entrenched in recycling. Their trash cans in their homes are very small because it's recycled. But here in Texas, it seems like a very haphazard system. And Dallas City, I know that they actually cut back on recycling. The landfill in Lewisville, Texas, has become a mountain. So my question is, how can we get Texas to start to recycle?
Thanks
properly?
For your call. I don't know if you've looked into this in your work, Matt, but is there really good money in the recycling business model?
So you're a good economist. And so my answer was going to have those two pieces. When the price of natural resources, whether it's lead or paper, when these prices go up, or aluminum, when these prices go up, Dick Cheney would jump into the garbage pile and start recycling. And so the economists would point to two factors for how to increase recycling in Texas. One is basically, as China and India continue to develop, that this will increase demand for scarce metals, and this creates an incentive to go through your garbage pile and to pull out to turn trash into cash. On the flip side, sociologists would say, does Texas have a culture of recycling? Have neighbors been, through positive peer pressure, encouraging others in a kind of keeping up with the Joneses sense? Or is this viewed as uncool if I talk to Texas teenagers? And so it would interest me of, is there a culture of recycling, or is it a lack of information? And I would want to explore all of these to explain the puzzle of why recycling is low.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. I want to go back to China and India, because another one of the myths that you sort of bust in this article is the idea that many people have that these places are, as you say, out-greening the United States. Can you talk about why that's not the case?
So a nation like India, with 1.2 billion people, one can find what they want to find there. So there's certainly some green tech projects going on there. But in terms of day-to-day quality of life, Beijing and Shanghai's air pollution is four times higher than a Houston or Los Angeles. And so it is true that they are engaging in some impressive green tech research designs. But it's in the news today that China might buy Hummer from General Motors. And so their cities currently have very high pollution levels, and pollution will actually get worse there with economic growth and with heavy industrialization. I'm cautiously optimistic that some of their technology ventures will work, and there can be a spillover effect that America's cities could gain from the new technologies that we could import from there and vice versa.
Is there reason to hope that the transformations, particularly of China and India, to fully developed economies at this point in world history, when we understand what we're up against, will give them a chance to start or at least move to the right path? As you know, if 20 years from now, as many Chinese and Indians have personal automobiles as we have in this country?
My hope is that they can skip our mistakes. And so, for example, pre-1975 vehicles in the U.S. are much higher polluting than cars that come out today, in terms of because the old cars didn't have catalytic converters. What I'm hoping is that as China and India develop and as their middle class achieve their American dream, that they purchase energy efficient and clean appliances, hopefully produced by U.S. firms. And so a benefit of globalization for the environment is the ability of developing countries to skip polluting consumer goods and to jump to our best technology if they're affordable.
You write that wealthy countries at this point really need to take the lead on developing carbon sequestration methods that we can share with the developing world. What makes this technology particularly critical, do you think?
What we're running into, it comes down to coal-fired power plants. The world needs electricity. We take our toasters and our air conditioners and our computers for granted. There's billions of people throughout the world who are just beginning to discover the bliss of logging into Google or listening to NPR on the radio. And these individuals are going to need electricity, and the electricity is going to come from coal-fired power plants. My nightmare is that could create a lot of greenhouse gas emissions. The way to avoid that is if our nerd engineers can come up with successful carbon sequestration so that we could have the best of both worlds of cheap power coming from coal-fired power plants but with less greenhouse gas emissions because of the sequestration.
Do you see evidence that it won't just be our nerd engineers at some point in the near future, that in fact these other countries will start to innovate the technology that will put them in the right place?
What I'm seeing at UCLA and the other universities I've been to is that we're importing some fantastic scientists from India, China, and other nations. And so I think we're going to import their nerds. They're going to come to our great universities like Rice and Texas Austin, and we're going to get these innovations. There'll be an interesting intellectual property rights issue of who owns these. I would be impressed if great universities in India and China are grown to be at the level of our great universities. So I think that's actually our comparative advantage, our great universities, in importing their nerds to work with us here.
Mm-hmm. How do we define green jobs right now?
So that's been a battle I've had with folks. So I've been asking folks the following multiple choice question, and I can't answer this. I'm not a good professor. So if I said to you, which of the following is a green job? A trucker who has oil in his in cargo but doesn't have a spill, a nerd engineer working on solar or wind power, or a weatherizer of a guy going house to house and making the home more energy efficient. On some level, to me, each of those guys are a green job, but they're very different. And so I think green jobs are sort of a politically correct term, and anyone could see that in any job they do. And so what will interest me is if the Obama administration promises subsidies for green jobs, of how will everyone be allowed to collect that money, of who would be denied. They're going to need a strict definition, and that will be very hard.
Yeah, are you concerned that this will just become sort of a political, maybe not football, but something that we can then apply money that doesn't specifically make a change and call it green jobs incentive?
Yes, and I think that's exactly right. My concern has been that the Obama administration will devote too much resources to green job subsidies, and this will take attention away from what we were discussing before of explicit cap and trade on greenhouse gas emissions and more clear incentives that economists support. And green jobs sort of sounds cuddly. It's like opposing apple pie, but it's a little bit amorphous to me of what it really means.
Do you think part of the problem in the resistance to cap and trade is that we don't want to give anything up?
We like a free lunch, and economists since Milton Friedman have been yelling that there's no such thing as a free lunch. And so it impresses me that the public does expect a free lunch from economists to get something for nothing. And yet, in the case of greenhouse gas mitigation, I am optimistic that there will be a little bit of short-run pain in terms of higher gas prices and higher electricity prices. But I think that we'll be handing our grandkids a much brighter future as we green capitalism and don't suffer any of the challenges that environmentalists like Jared Diamond or Paul Ehrlich have sketched if we don't take such actions.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Matthew E. Kahn. His book is called Green Cities, Urban Growth and the Environment. The piece we're talking about today is in Foreign Policy Magazine's May-June issue. It's called Think Again, the Green Economy. Let's speak next to Mark in Irving. Hello, Mark.
Hi. Great show as usual, Chris.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Kahn.
Hello.
I was wanting to hear your comments on, you kind of were touching on it. I jumped in listening about the recycling, and one of the things that first came to my mind with all these issues, whether it be the housing structure or the recycling, or as now you're talking about the conversation, getting people to the table to having this conversation without necessarily bringing the particulars of their baggage, if you will, with their point of view. And what I'm getting to is, like, for instance, in Portland, I know the one of the things they did to what I consider highly capitalized the recycling program was that you get a certain amount of baggage or garbage that they pick up a month for free, and they also pick up everything that you could possibly think about recycling in a typical American city curbside. So you don't have to recycle, and but it's provided for you, available. But if you don't recycle, then you pay per pound after your two free bags, which I would see as the height of capitalism. But when I've had that conversation with people, some feel like that's a little socialistic. And I think that dichotomy of thought process is the thing I'm interested in hearing what you have to say about, because out there you start oftentimes getting people speaking of capitalism as though it's really they're talking about our democracy and not making the differentiation between that economic status. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Mark, that's a great point. And to do your point just a little bit of justice, what economists talk about are property rights, of what are your basic rights. And so if I want a cappuccino, I can't walk into a Starbucks and say it's in the Constitution that I have the right to a cappuccino. If I want one, I got to buy one. In the case of garbage or polluting, I don't believe it's in the Constitution that we have the right to pollute or the right to fill the streets with our garbage. If we're going to produce that garbage, an economist wants you to have to pay for it. And so it's fascinating. What do we get used to as being free? And when something's free, we're implicitly saying that's our property right. Economists want a much more honest discussion about what our property rights are and aren't. And in the case of pollution, if you want to pollute, we want you to pay for that, because that creates the right incentives to think about greening your lifestyle and gets us a greener capitalism.
I recognize, of course, Matt, that you have a dog in this fight, but I wonder if you think that economists have a sufficiently large place at the table as we're talking about all of these things and trying to understand where we need to go.
I have always marveled that there's only two economists in the Congress and that it was more than half lawyers. And so as a younger man on my blog, I would rail, why are lawyers running Washington? Why aren't economists more important? In the new Obama administration, some terrific economists, so Larry Summers is everywhere, but he's sort of the tip of the iceberg. There's terrific economists throughout the Obama team, and I'm quite optimistic that economists are getting their say in Washington now. And I hope this is also the case in state capitals, but I don't know.
Our guest is Matthew Kahn. We're talking about his article in Foreign Policy Magazine. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Bob in Dallas. Bob writes, have air and water pollution gotten lost in the low-carbon parade, and wouldn't these be a better place to start, especially with China and India?
So Bob is on to something. A point I talk at length about in my Green Cities book is the remarkable improvement in air quality throughout the United States over the last 30 years during a time of population growth, extra driving, and a lot of income growth. So in the United States, I'm highly optimistic that we've made a lot of improvement in terms of air. In terms of water, there's all these articles out of New York City that there's bodies of water that are now fishable and swimmable and boatable that weren't in the past. Bob is right that in China, air and water have been getting worse. In recent years, starting with the 2008 Olympics in Beijing, Beijing has been taking its urban air pollution more seriously. I am very sympathetic that short-run quality of life in China's cities could be sharply improved if they address air and water. The interesting question is, with the rise of their middle class, despite being a dictatorship, will there be a political push to achieve what the United States has achieved in terms of local progress?
Is there a region of the world that is sort of a hotbed of cultivation for green cities?
So they take pride in this, I'm going to mispronounce it, in Brazil, in Curitiba. So there's certain planned cities in different countries. I think Western Europe scores very high on green city indices for some of the reasons we alluded to before. And so where the fight occurs is, why is this homegrown environmentalism? Is this the industrial structure? Is this just good geography? Of what is it about the culture that has encouraged environmentalism versus in others? But in the United States, I do think we have a number of green cities. What interests me is, if residents from a city like Houston visit a San Francisco or Portland, how many come home and say, I wish our city looked like that? Or is there sort of this self-selection that people who want green move to those cities and people who don't stay in cities that aren't?
What's your sense as an amateur sociologist?
I have been arguing that being a green city is actually a pro-growth strategy. Here's my story. In this Google age, many firms are footloose. They can locate anywhere. The interesting question is, where do firms want to locate? My answer is that high-skilled individuals want to live in attractive, high-amenity cities. And so this actually, if my story's right, this actually creates an incentive for firms that want to hire the skilled to go to nice cities. And then you sort of get a snowball that feeds on itself. And so I have been arguing and fighting with some people that green cities is actually the first step in a domino chain of economic development for cities.
We're talking to Matthew E. Kahn, who's professor of economics at UCLA. His book is called Green Cities, Urban Growth and the Environment. His article in Foreign Policy magazine is called Think Again, the Green Economy. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the myths and realities of the green economy with Matthew E. Kahn, who's professor of economics at UCLA. If you'd like to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Mark in Hearst. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please. Hi, Mark.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Okay. I was wondering what his comments might be on the solar satellite colonies in space program that was proposed by O'Neill back in the 1970s as a green solution.
Are you familiar with that, Matt?
I need to learn, Mark. Tell me some more.
Well, Gerard O'Neill worked with Stanford, MIT, and NASA, and came up with a program that would go the other direction than we actually went with NASA, and had more development in space, had solar satellites beaming energy back to the planet with using straight microwaves. They tested the science. Everything seemed to work, but people lost interest in going to space, and it all fell apart. But if it worked for us back if the technology was sound back in the 70s, why isn't this something we're doing now?
So I can speak. Mark, thank you. You just taught me something. I have one intelligent thought there. As we seek lower carbon energy sources, we're going to continue to need electricity. I'm a full fan that we need a portfolio. we need to try, we can't put all our eggs in one basket, and in the absence of carbon sequestration, we can't put them all in the coal basket. We're going to need to try many different strategies and then see which succeed, which will be the next Google. The question I would have wanted to ask the MIT and Stanford guys you mentioned on the solar space program is, what's the price tag? The Obama administration and Stephen Chu, this Secretary of Energy, they're going to have a finite budget. If what you're proposing could be experimented with 10% of the budget, I think I'd be a fan. But if you told me that it's going to take 90% of the budget, then I'd worry that that's not diversified. That we're going to have to try many things, and one of them will work through the magic of innovation.
I want to talk a little bit about the potential for greenwashing. And you know, many people who want to do the right thing will sort of consider going out and getting rid of their old refrigerator, which runs fine, and buying a new one, which is more efficient, or a car, or whatever else it might be. Are there good ways for people at the consumer level who do not have PhDs in economics to make choices about how their consumer decisions actually impact the health of the planet?
So this is crucial. And this comes back to what I was mumbling about before in this nascent field of environmental accounting. We're going to need some trusted authority, whether it's a future Ralph Nader or a Mother Teresa. We're going to need a third party who's credible to certify, a little like with Santa Claus. So Santa Claus knows who's naughty and nice. We're going to need someone with Santa Claus's omniscient ability to be able to classify products through these sort of green labels into which are green versus which aren't. So it would be a shame if somebody wanted to buy a car that's green but ended up with a Hummer. And so how we create these third-party certifiers remains an open question, because in the financial crisis right now, many people look at Moody's and Standard & Poor's and say, you guys did a terrible job determining what was a risky product versus what wasn't. And I'm worried the same issues could arise again if the incentives are set up wrong.
Well, and I'm interested in your choice of metaphor, because, of course, Santa Claus is a mythological figure.
I didn't know that. And that I'm always learning. Chris, what you're right about is the greenwashing raises a fundamental issue. When Matt does a green deed, whether it's buy a Prius or walk to work or not eating meat or recycling, did I do it to change the world, or did I do it so I could feel good about myself, that I'm a good person? If it's about changing the world and greening our world, then greenwashing matters very much. But if I did it just so that I could get this buzz that I'm a great human, then it doesn't really matter if it was greenwashing, because I just did it for myself.
I wonder if you think that it really matters if the green movement fixes the economy, if in fact the green movement fixes the environment.
I think it can. And so I look, people continue to debate this, but on several criteria, on air, urban, American cities and air and water, we've made great progress in the United States in the last 30 years on many local environmental criteria. A critic could say that our greenhouse gas emissions continue to rise, but an economist would say that's because we haven't had an explicit incentive to not pollute. But the U.S. has shown this ability to improve its environmental quality, as has Eastern Europe, and I'm optimistic that China and India will also. So there's nothing deterministic that capitalism has to destroy our environment. It comes down to aligning incentives, and then we can have this win-win of a green capitalism.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Susan in Plano. Hello, Susan.
Oh, hi. I'm calling from Plano. I have a question. I was interested in the speaker's commentaries on green skies, so to speak. Whether cities are, in the United States at least, are looking, as they are in Europe, some places, at the proliferation of we and all the kinds of cell phone towers and wireless devices that are, some physicians are starting to have concerns about and are even testifying about in France, at least, in other places in Europe, as well as the use of organics, and whether or not for these cities is really looking at organics, use of spraying and so forth as part of the green city concept.
Susan, I can only give you've asked a tough question. My hope as a scientific nerd is that our scientists will continue to make progress in understanding threats to public health. In my fantasy world, as our scientists make progress understanding new threats, whether it's cell phones or magnetic fields, that this information through the media, through shows like NPR, are conveyed to the educated public, and the educated public demands action from their congresspeople who then pass new laws. And so the optimist says in me through that process that through learning, through trickle-down learning, we will address these threats. But I'm very sympathetic that there are threats that we currently don't know about that we're posing to ourselves unintentionally through new products. But I'm optimistic that science will continue to make progress in diagnosing a big chunk of these. Because life expectancy in the U.S. continues to rise. And so economists are quite optimistic that our standard of living is rising, especially if we could take long-term efforts to mitigate climate change.
Of course, we have vast amounts of evidence that most human beings are not the rational creatures that economists might hope that we would all be. But I wonder if there's some lesson to be learned economically from the willingness of a greater number of Americans to pay more for things like organic foods. Even though these things don't sort of make sense for their wallets, they've recognized that they're important for their personal health and for the health of the environment. What do you think about that?
So, Chris, you just raised a crucial point. To return to Star Trek, since I know that movie is out, economists debate, are we fundamentally Spock versus McCoy? And when I was in graduate school, we were a bunch of Spocks, the logical, forward-looking, patient person rather than the emotional, bumbling McCoy. But McCoy was a good doctor. What you're right about is the rise of companies like Whole Foods, that there's certainly a segment, an educated, wealthy segment of the population in an inconvenient truth kind of way, who are willing to vote their pocketbooks on green products. What interests economists is that creates a free market incentive encouraging businesses with a profit motive to come out with more green products. Here's the question. If Dick Cheney takes a ride with Al Gore in Al Gore's new souped-up Prius, does Dick Cheney learn and say, this is a great car, maybe I should choose the green products? So do people who are currently not consuming green products ever learn from the subset who are greens and then switch over and go green themselves? If that kind of learning takes place, then I'm very optimistic that the organic consumers could green the whole economy.
And how do we factor in the people who are not, we'll leave aside education and just say who are not in a financial position to pay more for the things that they consume?
So an economist always has an answer. And my answer there is learning by doing. Whenever a new capitalist product comes out, it's expensive, like flat screen TVs or the first cell phones or the first personal computers. Economists talk about learning by doing. In English, what that means, the more you play a video game, your score goes up with cumulative experience. If companies get good at making a product as they make more and more, their costs fall and they can lower the price. And then Walmart might start to sell this product. And then Joe the plumber might buy this product. And so my optimistic story for how green products can diffuse and be widely bought all comes down to whether green firms, the Priuses of the world, enjoy large learning by doing effects. Because if they do, then the Walmarts will start to sell their products at low prices and they'll penetrate into the middle and lower middle class.
Do you think a greater impact will come from the sort of free market taking on greener things because of consumer demand, or will there have to be a greater accompanying government encouragement based on whatever kinds of laws that we decide are appropriate?
To build on your point, if I were President Obama's right-hand man, and I know why he hasn't picked me, people don't like me, I would have a big run-up in our National Science Foundation budget of a big core research push to push our great universities, Rice, Texas, Austin, Stanford, UCLA, to give these the best scientists the grant money to come up with basic research. So this isn't picking winners. This is subsidizing basic research. And then some of these ideas will work, and for-profit companies would partner with these university nerds, and out would come the next generation of iPhones, Priuses, and Googles, and then we'd have a greener capitalism. So I believe in private-public partnerships, but I think government has to be in the role of funding basic research rather than saying that the future is T. Boone Pickens' wind farm.
So you like the idea of the Manhattan Project for the environment?
except I wouldn't do it in-house. We've got, so in the Manhattan Project, the physics nerds during World War II went to Los Alamos in New Mexico. We have great universities, and this is self-serving for a university professor, but I would want to see the Obama team kicking some of this stimulus money to the universities so that the nerds have no excuses to fund our next generation of green products and green ideas.
How interested are the students that you interact with in this field?
They're quite interested, except the recession now has them scared. And so there's both hope. I mean, the labor market in California is ugly. And for a tenured faculty member, I'm sympathetic, but I honestly, and I'm an honest man, I can't put myself into their shoes. And so they are optimistic about the green economy, but confused about what role they can play, because companies like General Motors don't exist anymore. You don't join a company and spend 30 years there. You have to be quite flexible in the modern economy. And these young people are very smart, but trying to figure out how to start their careers and what might be a productive, exciting career.
Do you think, Matt, that the systems that we're setting up for ourselves now to try and turn all of this around and get back on a path that will allow us to sustain ourselves as the human race, are they sufficient to get done what we need to do, or have we sort of put three drops in the bucket and walked away?
Jim Hansen, there are two schools of thought. There are some who are saying if we don't get carbon dioxide or greenhouse gas emissions below 350 parts per million, we as a globe have a big problem. And I'm hoping that these guys are wrong. I think I'm starting to write a book on how America will adapt to climate change, of how could cities like New Orleans, if future Hurricane Katrina's hit, how can we do a better job saving property and lives when the inevitable disasters strike? But I think that the world's population will continue to grow. World per capita income will continue to grow. Carbon emissions per dollar of GDP are falling, but unfortunately, our greenhouse gas emissions will continue to rise. So we're going to have to get ready to adapt to climate change.
Do you think it limits our motivation to do something really extreme based on the fact that when global warming starts to really set in, if it does so according to the way scientists think it's going to, we will be less affected than many parts of the world, at least initially?
You're right about that. And so it's the old cliche that if you have insurance for your house, do you smoke in bed? So economists have the ugly word moral hazard. If you know you can get stomach surgery, do you eat a lot of bacon now? And so you're right that the expectation that we can cope with change, does that lull us into thinking that we, the United States, doesn't have to do anything now? I would hope in my goal that we do a better job at mitigating our carbon emissions, that we forget that. But I think that that's a very poignant explanation for why the United States has been slow to take up mitigating its carbon relative to island states like the Marshall Islands in the middle of the Pacific.
Matthew Econ is professor of economics at UCLA and author of the book Green Cities, Urban Growth and the Environment. His article for the May-June issue of Foreign Policy is called Think Again, the Green Economy. Matt, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.